Part 3. Chapter 11. Becoming Portugal. Vladimir Putin, who had never before been elected to political office, barely campaigned before the election, which because of Yeltsin's resignation was moved forward to March 26, 2000. As prime minister, he painted his vision for Russia only in the broadest strokes. His only real campaign platform or agenda appeared in a manifesto on the government's website on December 28th, the eve of Yeltsin's surprise appointment. The document was prepared by the Center for Strategic Development, a think tank founded by German Gref, an economist who was another of Putin's colleagues in Anatoly Sobchak's administration. In this 5,000-word manifesto, called Russia at the Turn of the Millennium, Putin frankly acknowledged the country's diminished social and economic status in the world. The country's gross national product had dropped by half in the 1990s and was now a tenth that of the United States and a fifth that of China. It would take 15 years of substantial economic growth just to reach the level of Portugal or Spain. Russia is in the midst of one of the most difficult periods in its history, the document said. For the first time in the past 200 to 300 years, it is facing the real threat of slipping down to the second and possibly even third rank of world states. We are running out of time to avoid this. The prescription was to restore national unity, patriotism, and a strong central government, not the restoration of an official state ideology in Russia in any guise, but a voluntary social pact that placed the authority of the state over the messy, divisive aspirations of its subjects. Its tone seemed almost religious, as if Putin were sharing a personal revelation of the middle road Russia would take between its authoritarian history and its democratic future. Russia needs strong state power and must have it. I am not calling for totalitarianism. History proves all dictatorships, all authoritarian forms of government are transient. Only democratic systems are lasting. With the duties of the presidency already his, Putin eschewed overtly political events during the short campaign. He held no rallies, gave no speeches, and refused to participate in debates with his challengers. Reflecting his dour character and disdain for retail politics, he was redefining the modern campaign in Russia in his own image, and in ways that would stifle the democratic future the fall of the Soviet Union had seemed to usher in. Within days of becoming acting president on New Year's Eve, Putin had co-opted his main potential rivals, tilting the playing field sharply in his favor. By the end of January 2000, the unity bloc in the Duma had orchestrated an alliance not with the Democrats or liberals, but rather with the communists. Unity and the Communist Party divided up committee chairmanships among their members, while shutting out Yevgeny Primakov, as well as Sergei Kirienko, who had won a seat after his dismissal as prime minister, and Grigory Yavlinsky, the leading liberal in Russian politics. Their supporters promptly boycotted the Duma, and as a result, a majority loyal to the Kremlin coalesced without regard to ideological differences. The country was learning that ideology mattered less to Putin than an orderly, pliant legislative majority. A week later, Lushkov, who had been re-elected as Moscow's mayor in December, announced he would not compete against Putin for the presidency. Primakov, who had announced his candidacy on the eve of parliamentary elections, also gave up, pulling out of the presidential race 2 weeks later with bitter resignation. I sense how far our society is from being a civil society and from a true democracy, Primakov said. By early February, Putin's most serious rivals, the ones who had terrified Yeltsin in the dying days of his presidency, had simply melted away before the official campaign began. One by one, regional governors then threw their support to Putin, even the man he had denounced as Judas 4 years before, Vladimir Yakovlev of Petersburg. The election, which had consumed Boris Yeltsin's final months in office, turned out to be not much of a drama at all. It was not a democratic competition among candidates so much as a referendum on the man already holding the post. Only one governor, Vasily Stadadubtsev, the communist from Tula, declared support for one of Putin's rivals, a fellow communist, Gennady Zyuganov. If there are no rivals, then there is no democracy, and if there is no democracy, then what was the point of demolishing the country? He asked. Putin had told Yeltsin that he did not like election campaigns, and now he dismissed campaign promises as unachievable lies told by politicians and denigrated television advertisements as unseemly manipulation of gullible consumers. Visiting the textile city of Ivanovo, he announced that he would refuse the official television time allotted to all candidates to present their biographies and platforms. "These videos are advertising," he said, belying his appreciation of the importance of television in shaping his public image. "I will not be trying to find out in the course of my election which is more important, Tampax or Snickers." Behind the scenes, Putin's aides nonetheless recruited a campaign staff led by the young aide he had brought with him from Petersburg, Dmitry Medvedev. They conducted a sophisticated operation to shape Putin's personal and political image, with all the tested techniques of modern politics, but little passion for actual democracy. The result was an image not of a politician, but of a man above politics. Putin's strategists succeeded beyond expectations. State television conducted a long biographical interview with him, which in his mind might not have amounted to a commercial, though that is what it was. And his campaign released a series of interviews conducted over 6 days by 3 journalists. In book form, the interviews were called «От первого лица», literally «from the first person», a phrase that also in Russian suggests «the first», that is, the leader or the boss. Boris Berezovsky, who still controlled the first state television channel, paid for the printing of the book, eager to ingratiate himself with Putin after his influence within the Kremlin had fallen dramatically. He and Yeltsin had not met since 1998. When the Election Commission banned the commercial sale of the book as a violation of campaign laws, Putin's headquarters simply purchased the first run in bulk and distributed the copies to voters at no cost. Putin, along with Lyudmila and others who had known him for years, recounted his biography in a folksy, occasionally frank manner that shaped his image as an ordinary guy, but also as the undisputed, virtually unchallenged ruler of a vast, once great nation emerging from its latest time of troubles. Putin managed at once to express pride in his Soviet upbringing and his KGB career while distancing himself from the failures of the Soviet Union. He offered everyone something to cling to, a cipher committed both to the past and to the new democracy, both a patriot and a religious believer. And no one knew for sure what he stood for, because he seemed to stand for everything. In his short months in prominence, the question, "Who is Putin?" became the refrain of journalists, academics, investors, foreign governments, and their intelligence agencies, including the Central Intelligence Agency, which set its analysts hurriedly to work to compose a profile, interviewing those who had had occasion to meet Putin during his years as an obscure underling. The strategy of Medvedev's campaign team was simply to let Putin carry on with his official duties as prime minister and acting president. It was no coincidence, of course, that those duties took him across the country for televised encounters that would appeal across the entire spectrum of Russian society. He visited Russia's space center outside Moscow one day, an oil rig in Surgut the next. He presided over meetings of his security advisors and an official visit from Britain's Prime Minister, Tony Blair. He pledged to pay all wage arrears by the end of spring. He raised pensions first by 12% and then again by 20%, actions that contributed to his rising approval ratings at least as much as the war in Chechnya. Putin would not deign to debate his challengers, but his remarks on the government's work received far more airtime than anything they ever said. He was not promising anything. He was delivering. Once the month-long campaign officially opened, he published a letter to voters in three major newspapers that amounted to a public break with Yeltsin's Russia. "The state machine is coming apart," he wrote. "Its engine, the executive branch, sputters and hiccups as soon as you try to get it started." He vowed to combat crime and declared that the war in Chechnya was a fight against the criminal world, not against an independence movement with historical claims to self-determination. In a barely veiled reference to Primakov's threat to clear the jails to make way for those accused of economic crimes, he made clear he did not intend to reverse the messy, inequitable privatizations of the previous decade, but rather to reinforce the state's control over the market in order to end a vicious circle of corrupt businessmen paying bribes to government workers and sapping resources from the budget that were needed to lift the poor out of poverty. "Millions of people in the country can barely make ends meet. They are skimping on everything, even on food," he wrote. "The elderly, who won the great patriotic war and made Russia a glorious world power, are eking out a meager existence, or worse, begging in the streets." Putin coined a slogan for his vision of a new, rule-abiding Russia that was secure and prosperous. It embodied the internal contradictions of his ideology, of his background as a lawyer and intelligence officer, and of his temperament. He felt it so deeply he used it twice in one letter. Russia, he declared, would be a dictatorship of the law. The biggest threat to Putin's popularity before the election, ironically, seemed to be the war that had propelled him to the Kremlin's highest post. The lightning push to the Terek River in the fall of 1999, cheered on by the public, now bogged down over the winter in gruesome street fighting for control of Chechnya's capital, block by ruined block. By the end of January 2000, when Russian troops pushed into Grozny, the military had acknowledged the deaths of 1,173 soldiers. Though many accused the government of underreporting combat casualties by not including Russians from outside the military and interior ministry, including the FSB or those who died of wounds later. The Russian troops suffered shortages of equipment, uniforms, food, and ammunition, and could not trust that they would not be killed by their own bombs. The heady burst of patriotic fervor that greeted the initial attack now faced the reality of a conflict that would be longer and bloodier than most Russians had expected. Putin's response was not to shift tactics, but to make sure that most Russians would not know the truth of what was happening. As the fighting ground on, the Kremlin strictly limited the access of journalists in the field, forcing Russian newspapers and television networks to cover the counter-terrorist operation almost exclusively from the perspective of the Russian side. Romanticized coverage of the Chechen fighters in the first war had bolstered their cause and sapped morale in Russia, and Putin was not going to let that happen again. News of the ferocious fighting, the indiscriminate slaughter of civilians, and the growing evidence of war crimes by Russian troops continued to trickle out, especially in opposition newspapers and foreign news reports. But the Kremlin's control of state television kept the most dismal news off the air. Reporters who dared to report the Chechen perspective on the conflict, or without official accreditation from the Russian military, faced arrest or worse. When Andrei Babitsky, a reporter for the American-funded Radio Liberty, was captured by Russian forces in January, the military did not simply charge him with violating the rules on reporting from Chechnya and expel him from the area. It turned him over to masked Chechen rebels in exchange for five Russian prisoners of war, as if he were himself an enemy combatant. Babitsky's fate caused an outcry at home and abroad, prompting sharply critical stories about Putin and his KGB background. Putin never sounded defensive, he sounded defiant, blindly so in some cases. He brushed aside any criticism of the war as an attack on Russia itself. What Babitsky did is much more dangerous than firing a machine gun, he said, when the reporters in first person protested that journalists in a war zone were not combatants. Pressed on the point, he simply replied, "We interpret freedom of expression in different ways." The American Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, raised Babitsky's case when she visited Moscow and met Putin in February. But after a three-hour meeting, she nevertheless emerged sounding charmed by Russia's new leader. It was not the last time Putin's foreign counterparts would come away with a view they would later regret. "I found him a very well-informed person, a good interlocutor, obviously a Russian patriot who seeks a normal position with the West," Albright said. Privately, she warned Putin that he was riding a tiger in Chechnya and again urged him to seek a negotiated settlement, something he never had any interest in pursuing. "I do not think we are any closer to a political solution in Chechnya," she declared. She was right then, but he would be proved right in the end. By late January, Chechnya's rebel commanders, battered by the aerial assaults on their redoubts in Grozny, abandoned the city and began a treacherous withdrawal into a trap. A Russian counterintelligence officer, who had previously arranged the exchange of prisoners, accepted a $100,000 bribe to aid the escape of a large group of fighters through a settlement near Alhankala. On the night of February 1st, the main force found the assigned route heavily mined. As they struggled through with devastating losses, Russian shells rained down on them. Hundreds of Chechens were killed. Among those badly injured was Shamil Basayev, who after the incursion into Dagestan was now Russia's most vilified foe. A mine shredded his right foot during the escape. The Chechens released a gruesome videotape of a surgeon amputating the foot, apparently to demonstrate to the rebels and others that, although injured, Basayev remained alive. On February 6th, Russian forces captured Grozny, at least what was left of it. No building remained undamaged. Most were destroyed and uninhabitable. Russian military commanders raised a Russian flag above the city's administrative office, but amid the devastation, they could not find a building sufficiently sound to serve as a military headquarters. The Russian authorities airlifted food and medical supplies for residents who had spent the winter in their basements. "The people should understand that they are not a defeated people," Putin declared. "They are a liberated people." The war was not over by any means, however. Thousands of Chechen fighters retreated into the mountains to join others, as many as 7,000 altogether. Maskadov still remained at large, as did other commanders. Basayev vowed to continue to wage war on the whole of Russian territory, and he would keep his promise. On March 20th, only 6 days before the presidential election, Putin visited Grozny for the first time. With Russian troops continuing to suffer losses in guerrilla attacks outside the capital, he braced the country's voters for a longer war than anyone in the Kremlin had dared to acknowledge. The war had stalled the stunning rise in his popularity over the winter, but with coverage stifled, it had largely disappeared as a campaign issue. While Russian forces had destroyed the majority of large illegal armed groups, many threats remained, Putin said. "It is the reason why we should not pull out all troops from Chechnya, but leave enough of our forces here to deal with current problems." Most Russians never learned the dark side of Putin's all-out war and did not seem to care if they did. Putin had arrived in Grozny aboard a two-seat attack fighter built in Soviet times. He emerged at the military airfield dressed like a character out of a war movie, swaggering in a pilot's flight suit. Stunts like this would soon become a staple of Putin's politics, the careful cultivation of the leader's televised image that one author would christen a videocracy. The television coverage of his visit to Grozny was so fawning that many actually believed that Putin had piloted the jet himself. By election day, the outcome was a foregone conclusion. The only suspense was about the turnout, since anything less than 50% would render the results invalid. Putin faced 10 other candidates, but most were little-known regional leaders or politicians like Yuri Skuratov, who was still fighting his dismissal as prosecutor general without ever revealing all the incriminating information he claimed to have against Yeltsin's inner circle. The most prominent challengers remained those who had opposed Yeltsin 4 years before: Gennady Zhuganov of the Communists and Grigory Yavlinsky of Yabloko. They were almost entirely ignored by the Kremlin and its state television networks until Yavlinsky faced a late barrage of campaign ads and news reports attacking him as a candidate supported by Jews, gays, and foreigners. The attack, appealing to the lowest common denominator of Russian popular sentiment, reflected a fear that Yavlinsky would draw enough of the country's liberals out of Putin's column to force him into a runoff. Either the fear was misplaced or the tactic worked. Putin won 53% of the vote in the first round, crushing Zhuganov, who received only 29%, and Yavlinsky, who finished with less than 6%. There was evidence that Putin's totals and turnout were aided by ballot stuffing, but no one really cared. Putin was indisputably the people's choice in what would be the last election in Russia that could still arguably be called democratic. Putin's ascension to the pinnacle of power was so rapid, so unexpected, so astounding, that a prominent Russian historian described it in otherworldly terms as the act of a higher power bestowed on a battered, grateful nation. Yeltsin, the historian Roy Medvedev wrote, had released his grip on power without revolution or bloodshed, without a palace coup or plot of any kind. Russia entered the new century with a new leader, acting President Putin, and almost all the population perceived this not as a cause for alarm, but as a providential New Year's gift. Only days before the election, the lingering puzzle of the apartment bombings and the events in Ryazan, colored now by the brutality of the fighting in Chechnya, began to gnaw at Putin's opponents. They believed that there had to be a conspiracy at work, with this small, dull man merely a puppet of larger forces. The independent newspaper, Novaya Gazeta, published a series of articles that deepened the mystery about the training exercise in Ryazan. The articles quoted the police corporal who had first entered the apartment building and the officer who tested the sacks of sugar and defused the detonator. The newspaper also found a paratrooper from the 137th Regiment, which was stationed at a base near Ryazan, who had been ordered to guard a warehouse. Inside, he and another soldier found dozens more sacks labeled sugar. Tea made with this sugar turned out to be foul and not at all sweet, the newspaper wrote. The soldier informed his platoon commander, who had an expert he knew test the substance. It was an explosive, hexogen. The paratrooper was identified only as Alexei P., and the evidence was purely circumstantial, but the newspaper suggested that the events in Ryazan and the bombings in Moscow and Volgodonsk might not have been acts of terrorists against the state, but rather terrorist acts by the state. Why was hexogen kept at a special service base, and why was it packed into sugar bags? The newspaper asked. According to sappers, explosives in such quantities are not transported or stored like this because it's too dangerous. Half a kilo is enough to blow up a small building. Putin's rise, the newspaper insinuated, might not have been a providential gift after all, but rather the result of an unspeakable sin. On March 16th, a cyber attack destroyed the next day's edition of the newspaper. The same day, the FSB, which had remained largely silent about the bombings since the fall, held a press conference to announce that its investigation had established the vast network of insurgents who had been involved in the attacks, which, a spokesman insisted, had been organized inside Chechnya. The FSB also altered significant details in its new account, especially those involving the explosives. Instead of hexogen, which is produced and closely guarded by the military, the FSB said, the terrorists used a more common mixture of fertilizers that were widely available. The FSB's confusing and shifting accounts challenged even those inclined to believe the terrorists were responsible. Putin, in the campaign interviews collected in the book First Person, dismissed the suspicions as madness. No one in the Russian special services would be capable of such a crime against his own people, he said. The very supposition is amoral. It's nothing but part of the information war against Russia. Who exactly was waging this war? Putin did not explain. Zyuganov and Yavlinsky raised the lingering questions on the campaign trail. NTV, the independent part of the media most conglomerate owned by the oligarch Vladimir Gusinsky, also echoed the accusations. NTV held a town hall debate in which residents of Ryazan questioned an FSB spokesman and mocked his unconvincing answers. At one point, the spokesman held up a sealed box that, he insisted, contained all the evidence, though of course he could not open it. It was a preposterous performance. Despite the official denials, the media and some in the opposition began to piece together odd incidents and reports into the shape of a conspiracy to propel Putin to office. Local and foreign newspaper articles in the summer before the bombings, largely ignored at the time, seemed now to have eerily predicted them, though the presumed motive at that time was to declare a state of emergency and cancel the parliamentary elections, not to start a new war in Chechnya or propel Yeltsin's Security Council director and FSB chief into the Kremlin. In July 1999, for example, a retired army colonel turned journalist, Alexander Zhelin, had published an article in Moskovskaya Pravda with the headline "Storm in Moscow, predicting terrorist attacks against government buildings," the goal of which was allegedly to discredit Mayor Lushkov. Berezovsky's close contacts with Chechen and other rebels in the Caucasus, which he had cultivated during and after the First Chechen War, suggested to his many enemies that he might have been involved in the hopes of blocking the Lushkov-Primakov alliance. Berezovsky, who ran for and won a parliamentary seat from the nearby Caucasian Republic of Karachayeva Chekasia, acknowledged meeting Chechen fighters and making large payments to them, including Basayev, to free kidnapped hostages. A transcript purporting to be of Berezovsky's telephone conversations with a Chechen leader, Movladi Udugov, suggested they had haggled over the incursion into Dagestan, presumably as a provocation to justify the invasion. Berezovsky said the tapes had been edited but did not dispute that the conversations had taken place. Berezovsky's critics believed he had as much at stake in the post-Yeltsin transition as anyone else and would stop at nothing to retain his wealth and influence. Berezovsky saw the world through the prism of his personal interests, the financier George Soros wrote. Soros had worked closely with Berezovsky until they fell out over a telecommunications auction, and he viewed the man as a con, as did many of Berezovsky's erstwhile business partners. He has no difficulty in subordinating the fate of Russia to his own. There were counterarguments that supported the FSB's version of the bombings. It was not beyond the Chechen extremists and their like-minded fighters in the other Muslim republics to commit acts of terror, after all. The political logic of the conspiracy also ignored the fact that the political elite had deeply opposed a new war for the reasons that now seemed prophetic. Launching a war was in the summer of 1999 seen as a liability, not an asset. And now, after the early military successes and all of Putin's tough talk, the war had become a drag on Putin's broader popularity, not the ballast it had been at the beginning. A survey of Russian voters found that the war in Chechnya was ranked as the worst decision of his first 8 months in power. Nearly as many ranked Putin's moves to increase pensions and wages as his best. Moreover, any conspiracy would have had to be set in motion before anyone, even Putin himself, knew he would become prime minister, let alone Yeltsin's anointed successor. The evidence for either version was ultimately never decisive, in large part because the FSB, under Putin, reverted to Soviet-like secrecy and almost certainly covered up aspects of the bombings and the events in Ryazan. Only days before the election, the Communist and Yabloko blocs in the Duma drafted a resolution requesting an official investigation into what had happened in Ryazan, but only 197 deputies voted in favor, short of the 226 needed. All of Putin's supporters voted against. Strangling a parliamentary inquiry to untangle the conflicting theories only sowed deeper and darker doubts. At the inception of Putin's presidency lay an enduring mystery that would shadow Russia for years, one that did not stop claiming lives. Independent lawmakers and journalists who pursued the question died with such disturbing regularity that it was difficult to consider their deaths mere coincidence. Even some close to Putin struggled to understand the facts of the horrendous bombings. "I don't know," Mikhail Kazyanov, a finance ministry official through the end of the Yeltsin years, said more than a decade later. On January 3rd, 2 days after becoming acting president, Putin had offered Kazyanov the job as prime minister, though it was not made official until after his election. Putin made the ground rules very clear. Kazyanov would tend to the government, the budget, and the economy, but the security services would remain in Putin's purview. The idea that bombings that killed some 300 innocent civilians could have been the work of the government that he had joined under the new president, or even of rogue elements inside it, was simply an inconceivable evil to Kazyanov. "I don't know, and I don't want to believe that it could be true," he said. Putin built a political team out of a circle of people he could trust, that is, his friends, which he admitted were few. "I have friends, of course. Unfortunately, or perhaps fortunately, they are not so many," he told the journalist Mikhail Leontiev during an interview for the biographical documentary that state television ran before the election. "Because then, you value the friends you have more. These are the people with whom I have been friends for many years, with some of them from my school days, with some from university days. The character of our relations is not changing. I haven't been able to meet them often recently, but the meetings still take place regularly." During the election campaign, he lost one of those few. Anatoly Sobchak had returned to Petersburg in the summer of 1999 after his exile in France. He was greeted like a prodigal son. Now that Putin had reached the heights of power, the criminal cases that had chased Sobchak abroad suddenly evaporated. Sobchak tried to regain the glory of 1991, running for a seat in the Duma in December, but his political star had faded and he lost. He nonetheless threw himself into Putin's presidential race, campaigning actively for his former aide. He was in Kaliningrad when he died suddenly in his hotel room on the night of February 18th, apparently of a heart attack, though rumors darkly swirled of other causes, perhaps even poisoning. Putin himself fueled the speculation with his rage and sorrow over Sobchak's death. "Anatoly Sobchak did not just die," Putin told Baltica Radio in Petersburg. "He perished because he was hounded." Putin's severity in ensuring Yuri Skuratov's defenestration now seemed understandable, since it was Skuratov who had launched the first investigations into Sobchak's affairs. Putin's role in the prosecutor's fall might have had a political purpose, but it was also deeply personal. At Sobchak's funeral, Putin delivered the eulogy. He called him "our master" and "one of the last romantics." For the first time, Russia saw its new leader shed tears. In May 2000, the Kremlin's protocol chiefs faced a logistical problem as they considered the inauguration of a new president of Russia. Since the 1960s, the Soviet Union's new general secretaries had taken the oath of office in the modern glass and concrete Palace of Congresses, an architectural anachronism that marred the historical integrity of the Kremlin. The Czars had been crowned in the 15th century Cathedral of the Assumption. Boris Yeltsin, when he won re-election, considered abandoning both and erecting an outdoor stage, only to have to move it into the old Soviet palace because of his frail health. Yeltsin was so ill, walking stiffly and speaking shakily, that he did not deliver an inaugural address and read his oath from a teleprompter. Putin decided to hold his inauguration in St. Andrew's Hall in the Grand Kremlin Palace, the former imperial residence built on the orders of Nicholas I. The Kremlin's planners knew precisely how many spectators could fill the Palace of Congresses, but had no idea how many would fit into the Grand Palace. To find out, they bussed in soldiers to line up at attention and counted them. They could not afford to overlook any detail. On May 7th, 1,500 people witnessed a new president swearing an oath amid the gilded, neo-imperial splendor that Putin's first boss in Moscow, Pavel Borodin, had renovated in the 1990s, bringing scandal onto Yeltsin and his entourage. Borodin could hardly have imagined that the suspicious, dour deputy sent to his office less than 4 years before would someday be the man with his hand on the new constitution in that hall. At every turn, the contrast between Yeltsin and Putin was seared into the consciousness of the millions watching either in the hall or on state television. Putin remained a political novice. He seemed like an actor in his stage debut. He arrived at the side entrance to the Grand Palace in a midnight blue Mercedes, emerged alone, saluted a ceremonial guard at the door, and then strode up the 57 steps of the palace's monumental staircase. He moved deliberately, but not hurriedly, along a red carpet through the palace's grand hallways. The cameras tracked him in an elaborately crafted pageant that passed applauding guests crowded behind red ropes as the soldiers had been. Putin seemed tiny in the enormous halls. He wore a dark suit and gray tie. His left arm swung confidently, but his right, possibly because of the fracture he had suffered during the fight in 1984 that clouded his KGB career, hung at his side. It gave his gait a distinctive swagger as he covered hundreds of yards, something that Yeltsin, in his hardiest days, would not have dared to attempt under the scrutiny of live television cameras. The official guests included the members of parliament, governors, senior judges, and the clergy of Russia's four official religions, Orthodox Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, and Judaism. Mikhail Gorbachev, whom Yeltsin had conspicuously snubbed for his inauguration in 1996, attended like an apparition of another era. So did Vladimir Kruchkov, the KGB chairman who had led the abortive coup to overthrow Gorbachev. The symbolism of their joint attendance signaled Putin's desire to project unity after the tumult of the previous decade. Yeltsin, looking pale and puffy, appeared with him on the dais to witness the oath, which was administered exactly at noon. During the elder man's short address, the lights of his teleprompter flickered, forcing him to pause long enough that the audience applauded, thinking he was done. Putin, 2 decades younger, spoke crisply and sweepingly, focusing on the history of the moment, which he called the first peaceful, democratic transfer of ultimate authority in the country in its 1,100 years, failing even to hint at the orchestration that Yeltsin had devised. The ceremony blended the conflicted history of a country divided over the meaning of its past and thus its future. Putin, in his remarks, glossed over both tragic chapters and great chapters, leaving it to the listeners to decide which was which. As the ceremony ended, cannons fired a salute from the bank of the Moscow River. Inside, a choir sang the finale from Mikhail Glinka's A Life for the Tsar, written in 1836 to celebrate a soldier's death in the war against Poland, and rewritten in Soviet times as Ivan Susanin to remove the homage to the Tsar. For Putin, the choir sang the Soviet verses. After leaving the Grand Palace, Putin watched a military parade inside the Kremlin grounds. He met Alexei II, Patriarch of Moscow and All-Rus, the head of the Orthodox Church. He then laid a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldiers, located just outside the Kremlin walls. It felt like a coronation as much as a democratic transfer of power. Russia had a new leader, consecrated by the ballot, and yet little idea of where he intended to lead it. Putin's rise to power constrained his family life. He allowed his daughters, Masha and Katya, then 16 and 15, to grant interviews for the campaign biography, but afterward they disappeared from public life, their privacy fiercely guarded by the Kremlin. Photographs of them rarely appeared, not even with their parents. There was never an official portrait of Russia's new first family. The girl studied at home with tutors, learning not only German but also French and English. In the interviews, they came across as ordinary teenagers who enjoyed foreign movies like The Matrix, but only ventured out in the presence of bodyguards. Their parents bought them a white toy poodle named Tosca, the family's first dog since the car accident had killed their Caucasian sheepdog in Petersburg. Lyudmila said her husband spoiled the girls lovingly, but acknowledged that they see him more often on television than at home. They had servants and a cook, which saved Lyudmila the frustration she had felt when she first cooked for him as a newlywed. Their life together, however, was no longer anything she could control. "I don't make plans anymore," she said. "I used to make them, and when they fell apart, I would get very upset and offended. But now I understand it's easier not to make plans for shared vacations or holidays or time off, so as not to be disappointed." Russia, like the Soviet Union, had little experience with the leader's wife assuming a public role as First Lady. Gorbachev's stylish wife, Raisa, had accompanied him often on his travels and took up public causes, but this was still a novelty that was not universally welcomed. Yeltsin's wife disdained publicity and largely avoided it, and so did Lyudmila. In 1998 and 1999, she had briefly worked as Moscow representative for a communications company, Telecom Invest, that had roots in Petersburg and links to a family friend, Leonid Riemann, who would serve as Putin's telecommunications minister. She earned the equivalent of $1,500 a month, but gave up the job when her husband became prime minister, though some said she continued to be involved in business deals. Now, as First Lady, she joined her husband at official events, especially with visiting dignitaries like Tony Blair, the first Western leader who met with Putin after his unexpected ascent. The Putins took the Blairs to the Mariinsky Theater in Petersburg to see a performance of Sergei Prokofiev's opera War and Peace. It seemed at first that she would play a more public role. After the inauguration, she embraced the issue of literacy, promoting reading and languages, and she founded the Center for the Development of the Russian Language, which organized projects with the aim of enhancing the prestige of Russian culture around the world. Except for the humanizing interviews, however, Lyudmila had no role in her husband's campaign and none in his governing. Putin himself bristled at even the most benign questions about their life together. When Mikhail Leontiev asked gently if he had time to see his family, Putin replied curtly, "I see them," and the remark was followed by a noticeable cut in the interview. At the time, Leontiev was struck by the state of the Putin's home, which had been used by prime ministers for the previous decade. After 6 months in office, boxes remained unpacked, and he noted that it had the air of a temporary residence. "We have been living in temporary dwellings since 1985, Putin replied, "and so we constantly move from place to place, and we think of our dwellings as if they were barracks. Admittedly, very nice barracks. You can live quite comfortably here, but it is temporary, a temporary abode. We live as if we were sitting on our packed suitcases." In his financial declaration, required by law, Putin reported that he owned three properties, including the dacha outside Petersburg, that had been rebuilt after the fire, and incorporated in the cooperative with the other businessmen from Petersburg, including the two who were involved in the early food scandal, Vladimir Yakunin and Yuri Kovalchuk. The cooperative faced a legal challenge from villagers in the area, but the eight succeeded in securing title to the lakeside expanse and turned it into a gated community, reportedly with a shared bank account that any of the owners could use to deposit or withdraw cash. Putin declared a little more than $13,000 in various savings accounts, which by Russian standards made him a reasonably wealthy man, but hardly a high-flying tycoon. Like the savings of most Russians, his had lost a lot of value when the ruble was devalued in 1998. He may have omitted some assets in his disclosure, as many politicians habitually did, since so much of Russia's wealth remained in the shadows of the unofficial economy. But before his presidency, at least, the Putins had lived seemingly modest lives. Until then, they seemed to have no more guarantee of the future than most Russians, who feared that one day everything could simply become worthless again. Putin saw in his personal experience the fate of all Russia. "Over the past 10 years, the whole country has been living like that," Putin said in the television interview with Leontiev. "And that brings us back to the problem we started with. The problem with stability." It was stability he promised and had now found for himself. Indeed, the family's circumstances had now changed irreversibly. In May, the Putins moved to a new residence in a wooded compound abutting a winding river called Nova Agareva. The estate, built in the 1950s, had served as a government guest house until it became Putin's official residence. The area around it was called Rublyovka, and soon other mansions sprouted nearby. With buyers attracted by the proximity to power, it became one of the most expensive places in the world to live. The Putins remained there for years to come. The men with whom Putin had worked in Petersburg under Sobchak now joined him in the upper echelons of the Kremlin. They included Dmitry Medvedev, who became deputy chief of staff, and Alexei Kudrin, who had repeatedly helped him find his way in Moscow and who became minister of finance. His former KGB friends, Viktor Cherkasov, Viktor Ivanov, and Sergei Ivanov, all took up senior security positions. Putin installed so many friends from his hometown that his government became known as the Petersburg Clan and was viewed suspiciously by the Moscow political elite, which was used to a monopoly on power and its perquisites. Many even speculated, with no basis in reality, that he would once again move Russia's capital to Petersburg, just as Peter the Great had. To protect himself from the Byzantine political intrigues of Moscow, Putin turned to those he could trust explicitly. It became a remarkable personalization of authority in the Kremlin, reflecting his deep distrust of the country's political elite. "I have a lot of friends, but only a few people are really close to me," he acknowledged. "They have never gone away. They have never betrayed me, and I haven't betrayed them either." He kept some prominent Yeltsin allies on his staff, including his chief of staff, Alexander Voloshin, and Anatoly Chubais, the reviled father of shock therapy, who remained the chairman of the state electricity monopoly. But the character of the Kremlin hierarchy soon changed dramatically. On the day of his inauguration, he officially appointed as his prime minister Mikhail Kazyanov, who had risen through the ranks of the Soviet and post-Soviet economic and finance ministries and was known as a pragmatic negotiator, respected by his counterparts in the West. The muckraking media nicknamed him Misha 2% because of rumors that he extracted a cut in the finance deals he negotiated with bankers, which he fervently denied. But his credentials as a market economist were unquestioned, and his appointment signaled Putin's careful but steady embrace of the privatization of the 1990s. More important, after the political turmoil that had seen six prime ministers since 1998, Kasyanov's appointment did not provoke a new constitutional crisis with the parliament. Putin's early policy choices reflected liberalizing reforms that were cheered on by big business at home and abroad. He imposed a flat income tax of 13% on individuals and cut the tax on corporate profits to 24% from 35%, effective January 2002. He pledged that Russia would have lower taxes, but also expect people and businesses to pay them, after a decade in which almost every Russian avoided them by any means available. Putin's new government adopted land codes that allowed private property to be bought and sold, and institutionalized labor rules governing private employment, removing some of the uncertainties that had paralyzed investment and invited corruption and lawlessness. Buoyed by rising oil prices and the slow recovery from the 1998 default, Russia for the first time balanced its budget. It began to pay off its debts to the IMF and others ahead of schedule. Yeltsin's presidency had been erratic, but it had laid the foundation for an economic boom. The gross domestic product, which grew 5% in 1999, doubled that in Putin's first year in office, and then averaged more than 6% for the next 7 years. The Wild West capitalism of the 1990s had created a decadent upper class and a host of shops, restaurants, and clubs that catered to ridiculously exclusive tastes. But now, the fruits of a market economy began to trickle down to the middle ranks of society, especially in Moscow and other cities. Putin seemed to be the competent, efficient manager he had been as an underling in Petersburg and then Moscow. He embodied the contradictions of Russia's progress, resting somewhere between a modern democracy and Soviet traditions it had not yet shaken. Putin's initial steps reflected both, and opinions on his leadership split according to which side of Putin one embraced. Putin himself seemed at times to struggle to decide which side he was on. Nevertheless, in a matter of a few short months, he offered Russians a break from the chronic chaos of the Yeltsin years. His goal was not to accelerate Russia's transition to capitalism and democracy, but rather to move cautiously, to provide a modicum of what most people wanted, as he would say over and over, stability. And even as war raged in the distant Caucasus, he largely succeeded. On May 11th, 4 days after Putin's inauguration, dozens of FSB officers raided the downtown headquarters of Russia's largest private media company, Media Most, which included the popular television channel NTV. They arrived in the morning, ordered the staff into the cafeteria, and for hours combed through the offices, seizing documents, computers, and, among other oddities, a decorative pistol belonging to the company's owner, Vladimir Guzinski. Guzinski's early life had striking parallels to Putin's. He was born a day earlier, on October 6, 1952, and lived in a one-room apartment with his uneducated, loving parents. His father, too, was a veteran of the Great Patriotic War and a factory worker. Like Putin, he considered himself a product of the street. He learned to fight to defend himself against drunkards and thugs in the courtyards of a bleak Soviet apartment block. The parallels ended there. Guzinski's grandfather died in Stalin's purges, and though Guzinski served in the army, he dabbled in black market trades and eventually took up drama. All of it, his education, his experiences as a Jew in the bigoted Soviet bureaucracy, made him a rebel against the system that Putin became so loyal to. He also became spectacularly wealthy, opening a consulting company at the end of the 1980s and befriending a city bureaucrat who oversaw the city's fruit and vegetable markets, Yuri Lushkov. His business soon expanded into banking, housing reconstruction, and the media. His Media Most named after the automated banking network he had seen during a visit to the United States, created a newspaper, Sevodnya, and later the network NTV, which would ultimately provoke Putin's wrath. NTV became Russia's first modern private television network, with a feisty news department that irritated Yeltsin's Kremlin with critical, often sensationalized reportage. Just as Berezovsky used the state channel ORT to attack Yeltsin's opponents before the election in 1999, Guzinski wielded NTV as a cudgel against Yeltsin's family. The rivalry between the two television moguls was so personal and intense that Yeltsin's former chief of security, Alexander Korshakov, claimed Berezovsky asked him to assassinate Guzinski. NTV kept up its critical coverage during Putin's campaign and aired a documentary about the apartment bombings that insinuated government involvement. Worse, from the Kremlin's perspective, its coverage of the war in Chechnya did not flinch from reporting the scale of brutality and suffering, as the state channels learned to do. NTV's owner and its journalists were slow to realize that the Kremlin's tolerance for criticism had diminished under its new leader. Putin had a particular dislike for the way he was portrayed on the channel's weekly satirical puppet program, Kukli, whose creator, Viktor Shenderovich, had been skewering the country's politicians since 1994. The caricature of Putin, jug-eared and bug-eyed, portrayed alternately as timid or malevolent, did not seem funny at all to the new president. In one episode after Putin's election in March, the puppet was portrayed as a czar, overwhelmed by a taller, plumper, cooing bride representing all of Russia. "But she's so big," he whispered to his courtiers. "I don't have experience with anything of this scale." A puppet representing his chief of staff, Alexander Voloshin, replied, "Just do what we've all done to her." Aides in the Kremlin promptly made it clear to the show's producers that the presidential puppet should no longer appear in its weekly satires. The motives behind the police raid at MediaMost were not immediately clear, muddled as they were by contradictory statements from the tax police, the prosecutor, and other officials. Putin, however, strongly defended the action the following day, saying that no one would be above the law. It was clearly a signal, and it established a pattern that would become a familiar one. "There will be no such oligarchs as a class," Putin had declared on the eve of the election. The raid did not immediately affect Guzinski's media holdings, which covered the events with zealous outrage. Putin insisted there would be no limits on freedom of speech, but no one on Guzinski's side believed him. The prosecutorial assault on MediaMost coincided with the first official visit by President Clinton to Moscow under Russia's new president. Putin had not made foreign policy the first priority of his presidency, though in April he succeeded in getting the Duma to ratify the START II agreement, negotiated by Yeltsin nearly a decade earlier, to reduce the nuclear arsenals of the United States and Russia. Clinton was now eager to persuade the new Russian leader to accept American plans to build a missile defense, despite the limits imposed by the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, a crucial Cold War pact credited with preventing an ever-escalating nuclear arms race. Clinton hoped to make missile defenses one of his last achievements before stepping down, but ever since Ronald Reagan first proposed his Star Wars vision of a missile shield, Soviet and then Russian leaders had furiously opposed any proposals to allow them. Putin would be no different, fearing that even the rudimentary defensive system Clinton was considering could ultimately undermine the last leverage Russia had as a superpower. Although Clinton wanted to make a deal, Putin calculated that he would have better odds negotiating with the next American president. His wariness toward the Americans had been heightened by Clinton's admonishments over the war in Chechnya. This time, Clinton also raised objections to the assault on MediaMost, with Putin, and pointedly in an interview with a radio station, Echo Moskvy, that was owned by Guzinski's company. Clinton later paid a visit to Boris Yeltsin, whom, after 8 years in office, he considered a friend. "Boris, you've got democracy in your heart," Clinton told him. "You've got the trust of the people in your bones. You've got the fire in your belly of a real Democrat and a real reformer. I'm not sure Putin has that." Clinton's visit ended inconclusively. He did not win Putin's support for changes that would allow missile defenses, nor did Putin heed his encouragement to respect a free media. 9 days after he left, the new Prosecutor General, Vladimir Ustinov, summoned Kuczynski, ostensibly to question him about the bullets for the decorative pistol found in his headquarters. Kuczynski arrived late and was immediately arrested. On August 12th, during the lazy month of summer holidays, Putin finished a last round of meetings with his national security advisors at the Kremlin and then departed with his family for Sochi, the Black Sea resort beloved by Soviet leaders for decades. They stayed at the presidential dacha that he and Lyudmila had admired from a distance during Brezhnev's rule. He would barely have time to rest. The next morning, he received a telephone call from the Minister of Defense, Marshal Igor Sergeyev. The early hour could only mean bad news, and it proved to be the gravest test yet of his young presidency. Russia's newest nuclear submarine, the Kursk, had lost contact with the Northern Fleet during a training exercise in the Barents Sea. Construction of the Kursk had begun in Soviet times and was completed in 1994, when the country's once mighty military reached the nadir of its post-Soviet decay. It was the pride of Russia's Navy, a giant warship designed to battle American aircraft carriers. Now it had gone missing in territorial waters off Murmansk, and no one knew why. Sergeyev, it seems, misled Putin about the severity of the crisis, perhaps because he had been misled himself by the Navy. The commander of the Northern Fleet, Admiral Vyacheslav Popov, released a statement declaring the exercise a resounding success, but made no mention of the disaster that was clear not only to Russian commanders, but also to American and other foreign militaries who had been monitoring this exercise closely. Just before Putin left Moscow, an explosion had ripped through the Kursk's bow, triggered by a misfiring torpedo. The blast ignited a blaze in the four compartments, which was followed 2 minutes and 15 seconds later by a much larger explosion, which was detected by two nearby American submarines and seismic sensors as far away as Alaska. The explosion sent the Kursk to the bottom of the sea, 354 feet below the stormy surface. The submarine had a crew of 113 officers and sailors, accompanied by five more senior fleet officers who were monitoring the exercise, the largest in the Barents since the Soviet Union collapsed. Most died instantly, but a group of 23 sailors managed to seal themselves inside a rear compartment, where they waited in the dark and cold for a rescue that was not forthcoming. A young officer, Captain Lieutenant Dmitry Kolesnikov, gathered the survivors, took roll, and wrote notes to his commanders and to his wife. The last, scribbled on lined ledger paper, was dated August 12th at 3:15 in the afternoon, nearly 8 hours after the first explosion. He folded it in plastic and put it inside his uniform. "It's too dark to write here, but I'll try blind. It looks like there is no chance. Percentage 10 to 20. We will hope that someone finds this. Here is a list of those in the compartments who are here on the 9th and will try to get out. Hello to everyone. Do not despair." The wrecked submarine was already at the bottom of the sea when Putin was told only that it was missing. He carried on with his seaside vacation, jet skiing on Sunday afternoon in the calm, warm water of the Black Sea. No one outside of the military chain of command knew anything was amiss, since the Navy did not publicly acknowledge the Kursk's fate until Monday, after which officials obfuscated and then lied day after day. After finally acknowledging that an explosion had crippled the Kursk, officials falsely insisted that the cause had been a collision with a foreign submarine, almost certainly from the United States or NATO. Russia's military leaders reverted to a Soviet instinct for secrecy, and so did the Kremlin. The press office curtly noted on August 14th that the Navy commander had briefed Putin on the rescue operation, but Putin himself said nothing until August 16th when he left Sochi, not to return to Moscow, but to attend a meeting of former Soviet states in Crimea. On the sixth day of the crisis, Komsomolskaya Pravda published a list of the 118 sailors and officers aboard, having paid a bribe worth $600 to obtain it. For relatives, the newspaper's report was the first confirmation that their sons and husbands were aboard, and by now almost certainly dead. Another headline in the newspaper directly challenged Putin. The sailors on the Kursk fell silent yesterday. Why has the president been silent? Putin found himself excoriated in the media. Another newspaper published a sequence of photographs showing a tan Putin, along with Marshal Sergeyev, playing billiards, and the Navy commander, Vladimir Karayedov. The caption read, "They don't sink." Putin's decisiveness in Chechnya, his bold promises to restore stability to the nation, these failed him in this new crisis. He seemed unable to control the military or an increasingly anguished and angry population, incited by television and newspaper coverage that displayed the sympathy and heartbreak that neither Putin nor his military commanders could seem to muster. Boris Berezovsky, who still harbored illusions of influence despite public disputes with Putin over his initial actions as president, telephoned Putin in Sochi on August 16th from his villa in Cap d'Antibes. "Volodya, why are you in Sochi?" he said. "You should interrupt your holiday and go to that submarine base, or at least to Moscow." He warned him that he was doing damage to his presidency. "And why are you in France?" Putin asked sarcastically. Berezovsky pointed out that he was not the nation's leader. "No one gives a shit where I am," he said. Russia initially refused offers of international assistance from Norway, Sweden, Britain, and the United States. Putin only agreed after President Clinton called him in Sochi and pressed the offer. By agreeing to assistance, Putin had to overrule Sergeyev and the admirals whose highest concern was not the crew, but the possibility that Russia's enemies would learn the secrets of its nuclear submarine fleet. When British and Norwegian divers, but not American, finally arrived with a rescue vehicle on August 21st, they succeeded in opening the Kursk's outer escape hatch in 6 hours, something the Russians had not managed in 9 days. By then, all aboard were dead. The waiting families, still clinging to hope, erupted in outrage that filled the newscasts not only of Gusinski's NTV, but also of the channel Berezovsky controlled. Putin had returned to Moscow quietly on the morning of August 19th, but continued to say little about the crisis, leaving the media to declare the country leaderless in its time of tragedy. That morning, Berezovsky discovered the consequences of critical coverage. Putin's chief of staff, Alexander Voloshin, told him flatly that the channel was working against the president. Voloshin, who had once been a business partner of Berezovsky's, now told him he should give up control of the network or go the way of Gusinski. Berezovsky insisted on a meeting with Putin in person, and when they met in the Kremlin on August 20th, along with Voloshin, Putin's fury erupted. He claimed he had a report asserting that Berezovsky's reporters had hired prostitutes to appear in news reports, claiming to be the wives or sisters of the sailors. "They are not whores. They are real wives and sisters," Berezovsky insisted. "Your KGB idiots are feeding you baloney." With that, Berezovsky's fate was sealed. Putin had come prepared. He opened a file and began reading about the mismanagement of finances at the state television channel. Berezovsky sputtered in protest, but could do nothing. Putin was cutting him off from whatever influence he hoped to have in the Kremlin. It would be the last meeting between the two, one who portrayed himself as a modern Rasputin, and the other happy to be rid of an odious oligarch wielding the power of television. On August 22nd, 10 days after the Kursk exploded, Putin flew to Vidyayeva, a closed military city above the Arctic Circle. The Kursk's home port was in this dilapidated garrison town, weathered by the unforgiving climate. There, the fathers, mothers, wives, and children of the submarine's crew had come from all over the country to wait as the tragedy unfolded, veering between hope and anguish, grief and fury. One of Putin's deputy prime ministers, Ilya Klebanov, had tried to placate the families 4 days earlier, only to encounter uninhibited wrath inside the city's officers' club. Klebanov, who oversaw the country's faltering military industries, looked shaken when one mother, Nadezhda Tilik, leapt from her seat shouting, "Swines!" A nurse approached her from behind and plunged a needle through her coat sleeve to sedate her. Now, the relatives gathered once again at the club at 5 o'clock, this time to see the president himself. And they waited 4 hours until Putin arrived at last. Dressed in a black suit over a black shirt with no tie, Putin now faced the reality of suffering. Not the prostitutes hired by unscrupulous journalists, as he had been told, but people genuinely bereaved. What he found was an angry mob. He had not finished his first sentence when he was interrupted by shouts. When he offered his condolences for the appalling tragedy, a woman loudly shouted that he should cancel the day of mourning that he had announced the day before. Putin seemed unsure of himself. He acknowledged the sorry state of Russia's military, but sounded defensive. "There have always been tragedies," he said. "You surely know that our country is in a difficult position and that our armed forces are as well, but I too never imagined that they were in such bad shape." When a man demanded to know why the Northern Fleet did not have a rescue submersible, Putin blurted out, "There's not a damn thing left in this country." The crowd angrily corrected him when he stated the salaries of sailors and officers, shouting over his answers and forcing him to plead with the audience to let him finish. He misstated the timing of the explosion and repeated the Navy's obfuscation of the cause. "It could have been a collision, or a mine, or possibly an explosion on board, though specialists think this very unlikely." The meeting lasted nearly 2 hours and 40 minutes, and it was never intended to become public. A television camera from one of the state channels, not Berezovsky's, filmed from a balcony, but the Kremlin released only the video without the sound, so viewers never heard his misstatements or the crowd's angry protests. One journalist, however, managed to record the event unnoticed. He was Andrei Kolesnikov, one of the three journalists who had interviewed the acting president for First Person. In his telling, Putin ultimately tamed the fury, especially with his promises of compensation for the relatives, 10 years' salary and apartments in Moscow and Petersburg, the details of which had occupied nearly an hour of the meeting. "Putin left it," he wrote of the meeting, "as the president of people who had been ready to tear him to pieces a short time earlier." It was a searing experience. Some in the crowd shouted that they did not want his money, they wanted their loved ones. Putin's political honeymoon had ended. The aura of invincibility, the charmed rise of the political neophyte who would restore Russia's greatness, was gone. Putin believed he knew why. It was not the neglected state of the military or the Soviet-like obstinacy of the Navy's commanders who continued to blame the Americans. He refused to accept Marshal Sergeyev's offer to resign or to punish any of the commanders who had so clearly lied about the tragedy. No, the cause of Putin's political misfortune was the media. "Television?" he erupted in the officers' club when asked why they had initially refused foreign assistance in the rescue, as widely reported. "They're lying. Lying, lying. There are people in television who bawl more than anyone today and who, over the past 10 years, have destroyed that same army and navy where people are dying today." In case anyone had any doubt whom he blamed, he appeared on state television in Moscow the next day to address the nation for the first time. After expressing a total sense of responsibility and sense of guilt for this tragedy, he angrily denounced those who would take advantage of this calamity in an unscrupulous way. Without using their names, he referred to Berezovsky's pledge to raise $1 million for the relatives of the crew, and mentioned the villas he and Guzinski owned abroad. No one missed the allusions. Let me put it more bluntly. Attempts are being made to inflate the situation politically in order to make some kind of political capital or pursue certain interests of particular groups. And they are right who say that in the front ranks of the defenders of the sailors are people who, for a long time, were contributing to the collapse of the army, navy, and state. Some of them have even put together a million. A single thread from everyone, and there's a shirt for a naked man. It would be better for them to sell their villas on the Mediterranean coast of France or Spain. Only then they would have to explain why all this property is registered in dummy names and in the name of juridical companies. We would then ask them where the money came from. Of course, Putin already knew. He had files already compiled. In the shady world of Russian business, few oligarchs could withstand scrutiny over their dealings, their murky acquisition, their tax dodges, their secret accounts offshore. As head of the FSB, he had established a monopoly on financial information, and as prime minister and now president, he knew where the skeletons could be found. This was, not incidentally, the method of the KGB once upon a time. The suspended investigation into Berezovsky's holdings in Aeroflot suddenly resumed the next month. When he was called to testify in November, Berezovsky ignored the summons and fled the country. In February, he sold his shares in the television channel to his former partner, Roman Abramovich, who turned them over to the state. Guzinski, who had been released on bail following his arrest in June, fled to his villa in Spain. In April 2001, Gazprom, the energy behemoth, seized control of NTV in a boardroom coup after calling in a $281 million loan it had given Guzinski to weather the 1998 financial crisis. The channel's journalist occupied the studio in protest but gave up after 11 days, and new management took over. Many at home and abroad registered protest to no avail. Putin from the start understood the importance of television to the Kremlin's authority, of its ability to shape not only his image, but the reality of Russia itself. Sergei Pugachev, a banker and friend who worked closely with him in the Kremlin at the time, marveled at how Putin would obsessively follow television news reports, even calling the channel's directors in the middle of a broadcast to challenge aspects of the reports. He considered the state networks a natural resource, as precious as oil or gas. He understands that the basis of power in Russia is not the army, not the police, it's the television, Pugachev said. This is his deepest conviction. Now, barely a year into his presidency, the three main television networks in Russia were firmly under the control of the Kremlin.